February the 10th, House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection. Welcome, members. Looks like we've got a lot of bills. We will not be moving any bills today, mainly because of some amendments and physical. We'll have a public hearing. We'll start off. We'll open a public hearing. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2043. Ms. Norman, anything you want to...
House Bill 2043 allows an agency ombudsman to treat any communication as confidential and not subject to public disclosure. It provides that if the communication is treated as confidential, then documents relating to the communication are also confidential. It prohibits the ombudsman and staff from being compelled to testify or to produce evidence if the communication or documents were treated as confidential. It applies to all communication and documents made or created before, on, or after the effective date. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Mrs. Stinson and Fisher, will please come to the before the committee. Please introduce yourself and provide us your testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chair Wisnant and Co-Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Naomi Steenson, and I'm the administrator for the Governor's Advocacy Office. This office provides ombudsman services to anybody who has a complaint or allegations or concerns regarding a Department of Human Service program or service. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2043, and the intent of this bill allows ombudsmen to keep information gathered during the course of their investigations privileged, and we support the legislation for the following reasons. First, House Bill 2043 will protect the identity of complainants and whistleblowers who fear retaliation or potential harm if they come forward with a complaint against a state agency. Individuals who disclose information or provide evidence to a state ombudsman during a complaint investigation should not have fear of reprisal. In a past case, we had a state employee who witnessed a serious wrongdoing of another state employee. This employee called GAO and reported what she had observed. This employee was very fearful and asked to be asked to remain anonymous. The report prompted an investigation, and the employee who was being investigated left state service when the investigation was completed. This ex-employee then turned around and subpoenaed the records from the Governor's Advocacy Office in order to file a civil lawsuit against the reporting employee. At this time, we made every appeal to not turn over these documents, but that we had no legal authority to do so. So this bill is important so that something like this doesn't happen again. Second, this bill will empower more people to come forward and request an investigation into their specific situation. In one sad case that we had, a mother with some serious mental illness was about to have her parental rights terminated. She contacted the Governor's Advocacy Office for help and sent a number of communications that clearly demonstrated how challenged she was in truly understanding what was happening in her situation. Just prior to the court date, a district attorney's office subpoenaed the files that we had on this woman. And the problem was, here she had come to us pleading for help, and now all of her communications were going to be used against her. This bill, again, is important to ensure that people can come forward freely and complain or ask for help without fear that their communications are going to be used against them or any documents they submit will be used against them or for the wrong purposes. Third, this bill does ensure that all state ombudsmen offices are conforming to the same governmental standards that the International and the United States Ombuds Associations have established. Right now, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman and the Ombudsman for Injured Workers do have federal laws in place that shield the identity of complainants and victims and protect them from being compelled to testify or produce evidence. If passed, this bill will give all of the state employees, all of the state ombudsmen the same rights. At this time, we are working with the Oregon Law Center and the Legal Aid Services community on a proposed amendment to this bill that will change and add clarification to the current language as to whose identity is to be protected and under what circumstances. In closing, the cases that do come forward to an ombudsman office can not only offer resolution to the individual case, but they can shed light on the larger systemic practices and issues with how an agency interprets their policies. This bill will make more people feel safe about contacting an ombudsman office instead of going to the media or writing an angry blog. And in turn, it allows the state agencies to be proactive in making changes in their business practices rather than reactive and defensive when a situation becomes public. In closing, that we truly need this statutory authority and protection that House Bill 2043 will provide, and we believe it will strengthen the assurances that there are systems in place that will hold state agencies and organizations accountable. Thank you for your time and willingness to listen to me, and I am available to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions? Representative Hovey? Chair Hovey, I'm sorry.
Thank you for being here. Do most of our state agencies have ombudsmen that this would apply to?
Well, there were quite a number listed in another bill. I know that the Department of Corrections has ombudsmen, the Department of Transportation has ombudsmen, there is a manufactured home ombudsman office.
Maybe I should ask this follow-up. Maybe I should ask it a different way. Can you tell me who doesn't have one?
I am not aware who doesn't have one. I'm not sure that Oregon Youth Authority has one that I know they do problem solving, but I don't know they have someone specifically designated to perform that service.
All right, one more question. And do you know if do we have in statute or in rule a policy on when a complaint comes in on when an agency actually discloses who that complaint comes to? I mean, do they just automatically disclose the name of somebody who makes a complaint, or is it only disclosed when somebody asked who filed the complaint?
It really is a case-by-case basis. For instance, sometimes if a state employee is calling about some practices that they believe are wrong that are happening in their branch office, or in the course of our investigation, they will disclose some information that validates the complaint. As much as possible to avoid retaliation, we do try to keep those identities from being revealed. Again, it's something we try to do as opposed to that we have the authority to do. Sometimes they do want them, but very often if we're referring something to personnel, for instance, we will not give them that employee's name, only to let them know that we verified that this person was an individual who worked in their office. There are some cases, obviously, with the client, if it's specific to their case, some identity needs to be revealed, obviously, to resolve that problem. Or it may be a family member or a witness who saw how an individual was treated in an office. I hope that explains it. It's really case by case, and sometimes you really need to come forward, and we certainly, if we get a number of complaints that are against a specific employee, we have made a record of all the complaints, what they were about, and how they needed to be resolved, and have submitted it to a manager for disciplinary evidence. I know last year a number of employees that we got repeated complaints on are no longer in state service.
Just one more question, Mr. Chair. So let me give you an example, because it's sort of unclear to me whether we really have a policy and or a state rule or statute that directs our state agencies when they disclose the name of a complainant. And I'll follow up with a different kind of a complaint, not about a state agency, but say I'm a citizen, I go to Craigslist and look at a whole bunch of people who are advertising to be contractors, and I call the particular state agency and say, Craigslist has all these people who are advertising for services and they don't have licenses. And so, and there's like 3 or 4, maybe 8, 10 of them. Yeah. And so I do that as a person. They take my name and then they contact those people and disclose my name to those people that I filed a complaint against them, for example. I mean, is that a normal practice that the state agency would just, you know, disclose that I filed a complaint against all these people that were on Craigslist?
I can't speak for all state agencies. I know that the Department of Human Services in their fraud division does honor anonymity of complaints. They're not going to say who divulged that complaint. We're obviously we're mandatory reporters, so if somebody is committing a crime or we believe that they are abusing a child or a vulnerable adult, any confidentiality would not apply in those cases. There are protections, there are certain protections about what kind of information can be shared, including to a complainant. For instance, if a family member is complaining about a child welfare case, but they're not actually a party on the case, we'll take that complaint and move forward and look into it, but we will not be able to probably come back to them and give them any specific information other than general information about what might happen in a situation like this or what the due processes are. But we would still be taking care of that issue with the agency. There is, in the Children's Ombudsman statutes, there are some address about keeping certain things confidential. But there is no specific protection written in Ombuds rules about protecting identity, although we do as much as possible.
Okay. Chair Hovey, okay. Representative Conger, please.
Thank you. Ms. Steenson, I was trying to pull a bill up so I could try to answer this question myself, but for some reason I can't. So given my IT limitations, I'm going to ask you, you mentioned an example where there was, I think, if I understood correctly, there was a lawsuit filed against the complainant, and your concern was that because of the lawsuit, the information that the complainant had submitted to the state and the subject matter of the investigation to your office, I guess, was discoverable. But I guess, would this bill prevent discovery in a lawsuit of all of the information that's submitted? And if you thought about how that weighs against the person on the other side of the complainant, being unable to confront their accuser, so to speak.
Thank you for that question, Representative Conger. For one thing, this bill allows discretionary authority. So I believe another testimony will explain some of the amendments that we want. In discretionary authority, it doesn't mean that we cannot turn files over when it would be the right thing to do. In this particular case, this person wanted vengeance and wanted to seek the identity of this individual. And while the Human Resources investigation did not reveal that and has specific protections in place, because we didn't have that protection, they were able to do so. So I'm not sure if that explains it. Certainly in cases where somebody has come to us with a complaint and we have in the course of our discovery, discovered some serious wrongdoing. We're not going to hold that confidentiality at that point. So I think it really is to protect whistleblowers and victims or somebody that's vulnerable.
And I respect that and I understand the intent, but I'm a little bit concerned that if you got a court order, for example, requiring you to divulge the information and the statute was in place, what would happen?
It would, Representative Conger, we would review it. We would probably go to Department of Justice before we made a decision to deny or to go ahead and submit it. We'd want to make sure there were more authorities looking at that and it would not just be an ombuds decision.
Okay.
We certainly have turned over a number of our records that were subpoenaed when it was appropriate and stood for the same purpose as we did.
Mrs. Stinson, thank you. Could you remain and let's bring up, because you mentioned in your testimony that you're going to be working some amendment changes with the Law Center. Could Mr. Mullen come up and join? I think we could talk about what we're thinking about doing. I think we had some of the same testimony yesterday in judiciary on another confidentiality. Thank you. State your name, sir, and give us...
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chairs, for the record, my name is John Mullen. I work with the Oregon Law Center. And basically, we've been working with the Department of Human Services on an amendment that would clarify that when a person has requested that the information remain confidential or if there's reasonable, the Ombudsman's Office has a reasonable thread of information that suggests that the information needs to be kept confidential, that we would be satisfied with having a little bit more of the limiting language that clarifies the role of the Ombudsman. I'd also mention to Mr. Co-Chair that we're very much supportive of the role and function of the Governor's Advocacy Office, and we just think that this bill is important, but a little bit of clarification in the amendment will be helpful.
Okay, thank you. That helps, I think, maybe committee members and myself. Any other questions for either one of these witnesses? It will be, so do you think it sounds like it's an easy amendment that won't take a lot of time to...
Mr. Co-Chair, that's correct. We worked out most of the details with the department, so we'll be seeking an amendment that we will be working on together.
And we have two witnesses opposed to the bill, so you might want to try to include them in your discussions to see if we can satisfy their opposition to the bill.
That makes sense, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. So we'll call up Mr. Fiscom and Mr. Gallagher.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, and I'm sorry, but I'm totally confused after that testimony. I thought I was dealing with a bill exempting all ombudspersons, working papers, and notes from the public records law, and I was kind of prepared to talk about that because we've dealt with that particular bill two or three sessions in a row or in the past, and we've always... the legislature's always decided not to exempt those records, and I could go into some details to why I don't think it's necessary to exempt those records. But what I really think we're dealing here is with something that we could work with and deal with, and that has to do with employee complaints. It has to do with discrimination. It has to do with lots of other things which aren't necessarily public records. Agreeing with Representative Conger on disclosure and having, having the ombudsperson sit up here and say, "Well, we might not disclose," is kind of a little alarming in that sense. I don't think she meant that. So if we're actually talking here about certain protections from certain activities and protecting certain people at certain times, that's something we as newspapers can deal with. And again, the reason I'm confused is I don't know if we're dealing with employee complaints and discriminations and lawsuits, or if I'm actually dealing with one of the largest exemptions to the Public Records Act of all the papers, et cetera, of a number of volunteers across the state from a number of agencies. The reason we don't think that those records should be just blanketly disclosed is not because we want to get into my mother-in-law who is in an assisted living facility who may make a complaint to an ombudsman. We don't want to look at her records. And I've said this before in other committees on these blanket exemptions. The real reason we ever go into those records is to both look at the activities of the agency to see whether they're doing a good job. It's part of the follow-up. We look at the facility itself. And if you want to go through the newspapers and look at healthcare facilities that have been exposed through newspaper stories, I think you'll find a lot of them. And I appreciate that we are, the Office of Advocacy does the same thing, and the DHS wants to do the same thing. But without citing chapter and verse, of all of the places in public records, to take the state health, the Oregon State Hospital, all of the newspaper stories that are coming out on that and how that's informed a lot of public opinion and help you making your decisions. So just a blanket exemption for all of these working papers. And some of the details here about just using the public records law this broadly and not going through the thought process they could have to have culled out the pieces that they really need to be exempted here. There's in 192.501 or 502, which is an absolute exemption, all names, personal information in these records would be redacted. We're not protecting the individual here. That's already done in the Public Records Act. You'd just be getting the cases without the names and addresses and the details, which we'd be looking at, let's say, I hate to use a negative, but a question of whether or not this facility was treating its patients right or its employees right. Getting into those detailed records when you're doing both the investigation from the criminal side and from the AG side and from the public side, you need to look at the records. But under 192, when we requested those records, we wouldn't get any personal information. Secondly, I've checked with the newspapers. We've never requested these pieces of information. There's always other ways to do it. This whole confidentiality, this putting these ombuds people in the position of being an attorney whose records are subject to attorney-client privilege, or putting them in the position of special confidence, I don't think that's necessary under the Public Records Act. I think they have that now. I would be happy to sit down with the Governor's Advocacy Office and see if we can't find a way to protect those things that I think they were talking about without exempting all of the notes and communications from hundreds of advocates across the state. I'd be happy to try and answer a question.
Let's go ahead and have questions before Mr. Fiskum, unless you're Mr. Fiskum's your testimony.
Mr. Chair, your call. I always yield to the chair.
Let's go ahead and have questions for Mr. Gallagher, since he gave us a lot of information before we proceed. Any questions, committee members? My gosh. You get a hole in one?
Sure, I doubt that. I think I whiffed.
As I stated in judiciary yesterday, we had a long discussion about confidentiality, so it is a hot issue, and I appreciate your comments, so I hope you will work with the Governor's Office and the Law Library, and we may even need a Department of Justice person, and I think the bill could use some clarification, as the gentleman from the Law Center, Mr. Mullen, said about limiting and clarifying this, because we had, and I think also I'll do some research on the government ombudsman standards by the U.S. Ombudsman Association to see, and I also like to know how other states have used those standards, and you might want in your discussions look at that to see if that helps.
Mr. Chair, we have done that. This is I can understand why the association, which of ombuds people, and their special relationship to their clients, why they would feel this way. Unfortunately, the public records law is not covering small picture issues. It's covering big picture issues. Protecting the relationship of the ombudsperson with their clients, I think, is something we support. I don't think you need public records exemptions to do that. And the reason I say that is because in the entire history of the Public Records Act, there's no complaint coming forward from the ombuds people that these records were ever misused for purposes of destroying that relationship.
Thank you. Mr. Fiskum, thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's always a pleasure to join Mr. Gallagher at the witness table. For the record, Dave Fiska, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, which includes 200 radio and TV stations around the state. Our interest in public records, Mr. Gallagher knows, is often perhaps from our news standpoint in the broadcast industry a little less than is the newspaper interest, but at the same time, we share all of Mr. Gallagher's comments about the importance of the public records law. If you read ORS 192-500, and I have done that as a state employee in my past as well as in this role, there already are a number of exemptions there designed to protect, in the main at least, appropriately confidential information. It's also going to be true this session that the public records law 192-500 will be the subject of Attorney General John Kroger's proposal to reevaluate all of those exemptions and sections and issues. We tend to stand on the side of the public, the balancing act that always occurs with regard to the public's right to know, which can be carried out by the media, including radio and TV reporters. At the same time, Mr. Gallagher is exactly right. This particular specific issue relative to ombudspersons has never come up in our experience as to wanting something that was a question mark or a concern. That's not the kind of thing that lends itself to, frankly, news coverage, especially broadcast news coverage. I think with Mr. Gallagher that it would be relatively easy, if necessary, to work out appropriate amendments here to make sure that there isn't something already in the public records law which provides the protections that the witnesses have said is necessary. So we're pleased to work with them, and it can be done, Mr. Chair, fairly quickly, I believe. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Questions, committee members? Chair Hobie.
Thank you. I understand your concerns on that. My one concern is about the person that's making the complaint. And are there, you know, because I worry about somebody not willing to come forward and make a complaint because they fear reprisal of whether it's physical reprisal or economic reprisal or, you know, maybe a loss of a job or something. And so is there something in place currently that would protect individuals' names and from that public record disclosure?
Mr. Co-Chair Hovey, I think that's a question which there's two answers to. There's a whole lot of legal protection for whistleblowers and against discrimination. It's not in the Public Records Act, all right? So there's the Bureau of Labor. That's a significant issue. On the other hand, many times those are also an issue in which there are two sides. So an employee can complain incorrectly, inaccurately, can blacken the record of their the facility they work for, et cetera. So I think there needs to be a way to adjudicate those. This just is a blanket exemption. I can't see anything about it. So I think if the nursing homes are really concerned, they'd be in here. I don't think they are. But the other side of your question is there protection for individuals under confidentiality in terms of names, home addresses, that kind of information? And yes, that's in 192.502 sub 2, I think. I left it back in my pile. And that means when those records are turned over, all of that personal information is redacted, including personal medical information. One of the reasons we don't usually use these kind of records is the cost of doing that is extraordinary. Now, there's another issue here that you are raising, though, and that's other people in the public's right to go in and get those records. They would still be redacted. If a company wanted to go back in and retaliate against an employee by pulling a particular set of forms from the agency under the public records law, they could do that, and they would get it redacted, I'll bet you they could figure out who it was from that. So my answer to your question is that something we should be dealing with through the public records law, or is that something we should be dealing with through employee protection? And I'm not sure there's quite an answer to that. What I would say here is what I was sitting in the back of the room thinking is we've never really said in the public, in this particular section, I wouldn't put it in 501, 192, 192, 501, I'm sorry. I might want to see in this statute permission for the agency not to release these records to parties who were involved unless it was in litigation, unless it was under disclosure, which would be a way of having the record open for the general public but protecting that employee through the inadvertent use of the Public Records Act. The reason I say that, and I don't mean to rattle on here, is that we had a case, a bill where we exempted public records for law enforcement officers where the bad guys were going down to the public, to the city hall and getting their property records and locating their addresses. And there's a section in the statute to protect those law enforcement officers. So what I am saying is carving out these kind of public interest exceptions rather than this giant blanket exemption is something we always participate in because it does balance between the public's right to know and the person's right to privacy.
Mr. Coach, just a quick additional comment. I would agree with what Mr. Gallagher said. I would say that rarely in the broadcast industry from a news or public affairs standpoint is there a news stake, if you will, in divulging that kind of personal confidential information, unless, again, from a news judgment, a complainant is identifying something in a public facility, which is a matter of public interest. And Mr. Gallagher has rightly pointed out issues related to the state hospital, and I will let you imagine what the others could be. But the members of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters subscribe, perhaps imperfectly on a day-to-day basis, but subscribe to a self-policing code of conduct relative to, for example, the use of names in 911 tapes that broadcasters might have access to, and this body, this session, will consider a bill on that subject as well. The code of conduct and code of ethics to which we subscribe, our members subscribe, is designed to protect the appropriate confidentiality of persons, as well as to avoid just simple issues of embarrassment. And then Mr. Gallagher has raised issues that go beyond that, where someone's safety could literally be at stake. This is a tough issue. There may be multiple statutes that should be reviewed to protect appropriately the confidentiality of persons. I think, in part, ORS 192-500 and extensions already does that to a substantial degree, but we'll be happy to look at changes if somebody wants to advocate them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony from both of you, and we'll look forward to something to come back to us that we can look at. With that testimony, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2043. We'll open a works public hearing on House Bill 2095. I think we'll just have the people come up, and I think the committee is aware of this one. Let's go ahead and bring Teresa Miller first. Mrs. Miller, Ms. Miller from the Insurance Division, please. Did you want someone up with you on this one first?
I think I can do it by myself.
Okay. I thought that last one would take 15 minutes, so you only have 15 minutes, Teresa, for this one.
I'll be quick. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm pleased to be here today to testify in support of House Bill 2095, which would make Oregon a member of the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Compact. The Department of Consumer Business Services, through the Insurance Division, must approve most insurance products before those products are available on the market. And this state approval provides important consumer protections for products that vary depending on location. These are products like health insurance, automobile insurance, and homeowners insurance. But for certain insurance products like life insurance or annuities, products that typically don't vary from state to state and tend to travel with a person as they travel across state lines and really don't vary or aren't sensitive to local costs and conditions, for these products, a national standard really can protect consumers' interests. Historically, if a company wanted to offer a new life insurance or annuity product on a national basis, it would have to go through separate regulatory processes in essentially 56 jurisdictions, the 50 states, D.C., and the territories. And this process could result in a company submitting 30 or 40 different versions of the same product to satisfy state-specific requirements, and could take more than a year to obtain all the necessary approvals. And moreover, when you look at the shelf life of certain annuity products, the shelf life may be as short as 24 or 48 months. So under the current system, some product designs that could be valuable to Oregon consumers are never sold in Oregon simply because companies fear that the products would essentially be obsolete by the time they obtained the required approval. So the compact, the Interstate Compact, was created to try to address that problem. The compact process allows insurance companies to get products approved and on the market in a timely and cost-effective manner. There are currently 37 states, along with Puerto Rico, that belong to the compact, which reviews and approves insurance products that meet uniform standards that include strong consumer protections. Once approved, those products can then be sold in all the participating states. And the compact covers products in essentially four insurance lines: life insurance, annuities, long-term care insurance, and disability insurance. As a member of the compact, Oregon would participate in the development of product standards and would be able to ensure strong consumer protections. New products would be more quickly available to Oregon consumers, and insurers would be able to offer a greater variety of products in Oregon. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the compact provides that a member state can opt out of a particular uniform standard if that state determines or finds that additional consumer protections are necessary. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you for your very concise presentation. Committee members? Chair Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question. Once the state would approve this product, or the compact approves it and the state adopts that approval, could the state come back and rescind that approval at a later date?
Mr. Co-Chair, once we're a member of the compact, if the compact approves that product, we do have the opportunity to opt out of that product approval. We do have to provide notice and then go through a rulemaking, but we can opt out of that product approval.
Follow up?
Yes.
So I understand that piece, but say you didn't opt out. So after the fact, you decide that, oh, this product really, we need better consumer protection. Can you opt out later after the approval has taken place?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking to the back of the room, and I understand the answer to that question is yes.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, excuse me, how many times, do we know, and maybe it's unknowable, but do we know how frequent that is, how often folks have opted out?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Smith, I don't have the number of times that a state has opted out. I do know, and I'm sure I can get that for you, I do know that from talking to states who are compact members, once states provide notice that they're intending to opt out, what typically happens is the participating states then work very closely with that state with concerns and addresses those concerns. So I know I've talked to states who have had those concerns addressed, and they didn't end up opting out simply because their concerns were addressed.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many people are currently employed with the task of just approving these on a statewide basis?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Sheehan, are you talking about at our department?
Yeah, yes.
We have three individuals who on a full-time basis look at these products that would be covered by the compact.
Would they, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Thank you.
Would they need, would those positions be necessary if we had this compact?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan, that's a good question. I don't foresee that we would have a staff reduction by joining the compact, and there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, there are a relatively small number of filings going through the compact today, and I think when I talk to companies, what I hear is even when the compact's up and running and fully operational, there will still be state-specific products that will come to the state, so we will still need to review those. Additionally, to ensure that we do have sufficient consumer protections, I think some of the time that these individuals currently spend reviewing products and ensuring they meet these standards would be spent helping to develop the standards for the compact. So, again, to just ensure we have adequate consumer protection. So I don't envision a reduction in staff because of this.
Thank you. Good question. Other questions? Ms. Miller, you had good testimony, and I think you visited most of the committee members. On page 3, it talks about how on the long-term health care that by signing up, we're assuring the customer equal or better protection, but not less than the compact. But we only do that for long-term health care. How about the other three items? Is that guarantee in there also? Is that assumed? Want to wait and ask Mr. Manigan that?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking back in the back of the room.
I'll ask that to John.
And there may be other people presenting who can answer that as well.
Thank you very much. Other questions, committee? Okay, thank you, Ms. Miller, for bringing forth this. And committee members, I hope you did get around, and she answered Representative Sheehan's question, but also we hope that it's going to save the consumers, and I guess we'll get that presentation later. Next is, could Mr. Mangan want to come up? John, do you want to come? Mr. Powell, do you want to come up with him? State your name, sir.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President of the American Council of Life Insurers, a trade group. We represent 300 life insurance companies, most of which do business in Oregon, including Standard Insurance Company of Portland, State Farm, Allstate Farmers, MetLife, many other companies that you would recognize. And we're here today to testify in support, strong support, of HB 2095. I'm also instructed today to speak on behalf of Roger Beyer and his NAFA group, which is the Life Insurance Agents of Oregon, 500 members who are essentially small businesses in each of your communities that sell our products. They're also in support of the bill. The reason we support this bill in brief terms is that it will offer, as Ms. Miller said, more consumer options. We believe over time our products will be more affordable. Our companies will benefit because they will sell more products, earn more revenue, pay more taxes in Oregon. And, of course, our companies pay a high rate of taxation. Out-of-state companies essentially pay a premium tax rate, which is a gross premiums tax. So for every new product we sell in Oregon, that's more revenue to the general fund. So we think this is good for our companies, good for jobs, good for sales. Let me tell you what this compact would not do. It would not lower consumer standards in our view. In fact, we've been working very closely with the regulators here in Oregon and around the country to ensure that the standards in place meet or exceed all the standards that exist in the country. Now, that may vary from state to state somewhat, but in total, we believe the standards in the compact are going to meet virtually every state's requirements. And we designed it that way so that we could give you the assurance when we asked you to approve this compact that you were not going to be lowering consumer standards. I'll tell you another thing, and that is that I don't believe this will reduce staffing in the insurance division. And in fact, I think what it'll do is it'll allow some of the staff there who currently focus on routine reviews of products that are not controversial, that are coming in by the hundreds and thousands from our companies, which are not creating complaints. And instead of focusing on those, they can focus on the more complex products, the new innovations in life and disability and long-term care that are out there. They'll be spending their time where it really should be spent, which is on tougher, more complicated products and getting those into shape so that consumers are protected in Oregon. Bottom line, of course, we fund the insurance division through a premium tax assessment. We pay for our own regulation. I don't believe there's any plan to reduce our fees, at least I haven't been told, that we're going to get a discount because of this bill. So we're going to keep paying, and so I think the division will be adequately staffed to protect consumers going forward. With that, I'm happy to answer questions that have already come up or other questions that you may have.
Thank you, sir. Committee members, questions? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How would this both positively and negatively affect an insurance broker or an insurance agent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan, the support of the agents, I think, is based on the fact that a broker is in close touch with their clients. And right now, in the personal finance and protection area, annuities, long-term care, life insurance, their customers want new products. They want better protection. And in order to get those new innovations to market and really sell their product to their customers, they need to get our products on the market. And so the faster we can do that, the more innovations we can bring to market, it will definitely increase the sales level of brokers and agents throughout the state. So it's good for their small business.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Mangle, would you comment on my question I gave Mrs. Miller about the standard as far as it mentions, the bill mentions long-term health care, that we're going to get at least equal or better, but not less, and it doesn't mention the other three.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. We believe that the standards in the compact, not just for long-term care, but for all products, life insurance, annuities, disability income, will all be at the level, again, meeting or exceeding state requirements that are currently in place. So, again, that decision has been, we've reached that point by working with regulators in each state, including Oregon, including the forms filing people here, who have helped shape the standard to make sure that it meets Oregon's needs in all those product areas.
Thank you. Mr. Powell, please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Powell, before you today, representing two insurers, State Farm Insurance Company, obviously a national company that writes a lot of these products, and Standard Insurance Company, domiciled in Portland, Oregon, for the last 104 years and employs 2,200 Oregonians. We strongly support this legislation, and I will not repeat what Mr. Mangan or the Administrator of the Insurance Division has said, but I think it is important to realize that by joining the compact, you do not give up your state regulatory powers. The state will still have all the powers to regulate each insurer, both in terms of market conduct studies and exams and consumer complaints. So there's nothing being lost in that regard. We just think that on types of products like life, annuity, and long-term care, that if you moved from this state to another state, you're going to take those products with you, unlike your homeowner's policy, unlike your auto policy. So we think this makes sense from a regulatory point of view, and we do not believe it will diminish consumer protection.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions? Boy, another ace hole in one. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Bennett, please. Good morning, sir. Please state your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chairs, member of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon, here in support of House Bill 2095. AARP has been supportive of the creation of the commission, a compact, and at the national level, we track its work very closely. We provide comment when appropriate on behalf of our members and consumers. I must say that this is one of those unique circumstances where, in fact, AARP and insurers are actually on the same side of an issue. More often than not, we're on opposing sides. But we actually believe that this is very good for consumers. We think the fact that it allows new products to get to the marketplace sooner is good for consumers. We also think that, in fact, by states pooling their resources in the review and approval process of these particular products, indeed, we would hope it frees up resources at the state level to, in fact, do more review of conduct in the market and in other consumer protections. And, again, we would urge your support and passage of this bill.
Thank you very much. Questions, committee members?
Yeah, one question.
Yes, Chair Hogan.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for that testimony. Does AARP itself, they have insurance products themselves, I believe. Do they have any products like this?
Well, first of all, I would say, just for the record, Mr. Chair, we do not sell insurance.
Okay.
We have a very rigorous contracting process where we develop products with insurers that we hope will benefit our members, and we brand those products, but we are not an insurer. We do not sell insurance, and we are clearly a spokesperson for consumers.
Clear.
follow up?
Yes.
So I appreciate that comment, but sometimes I see advertisements on TVs and people ask me, I said, gee, I didn't know AARP sold insurance because you advertise for certain products and you can call AARP. So basically you're referring to another insurer?
Like I said, we have contractual agreements on certain products with insurers like United Health or Hartford or Aetna. And again, we look at those products and particularly the ones that we brand and determining what we believe will be in the best interest of our members. And some of those products have rather unique benefits and so forth that we believe are more in tune with our membership who are 50 and older.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification.
Representative Cameron?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, you represent those products. Do you get revenue off of those products when
they're
sold?
We do receive royalties for them, yes.
Okay, so there is...
sell those, yes.
So there is a sales portion to what you do.
There is indeed. We have a for-profit subsidiary that is involved in the branding of those products and so forth. Approximately 95% of the proceeds from those royalties go to our nonprofit corporation, of which I am a part. There is a firewall between the service subsidiary and the work I do related to public policy.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett, thank you very much for your testimony and coming forth today and working to give us your view. We have Mr. Bill, is it Sandhun? Sandhu, I'm sorry. Thank you, sir. Please come forth. Welcome your testimony. And as required, please state your name, sir, and present your testimony.
Okay. My name is Bill B., but I go by Bill Sandhu. I'm a farmer, rates and farms compliance officer for State of Oregon from 1985 through 2002, when I retired in January. When I looked at this law, I could not see why this is needed. I am sending you my testimony. I'll read that and I will answer your questions. I do not see the need for this bill since Oregon already has excellent laws for life and health insurance products. Oregon Insurance Commissioner's Office already approves these products for the insurance buying public. Why transfer this authority to the private organization, which I don't understand? House Bill 2224 was approved two sessions ago by the legislature. This law required that the life insurance products approved by the compact meet the same or higher standards of Oregon laws. And this bill does not have that I see it. House Bill 2095 does not require the same standards, sir. This is unacceptable for insurance buying public. The standard should be same as or higher as in House Bill 2224, sir. House Bill 2095 appears to give Oregon legislative authority to the Compact Management Committee, where the state may not be represented most of the time. This bill weakens protection for the Oregon insurance buying public. As I stated above, currently all insurance products must meet or exceed the standards set by Oregon law. This bill would allow insurance companies to avoid the laws that legislature has passed to protect the insurance buying public. House Bill will only serve the needs of the insurance companies, not the insurance buying public. Which I don't have it here, but I'm wondering why this bill is needed. What problem is it going to solve for the Oregon insurance buying public? This is why I say this bill should not be approved as it is written, sir.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions?
I guess I'll just...
Representative Smith?
Thanks, Thanks for your testimony. Maybe you've answered the question that I had after Rick's testimony, which is, I see the benefit to the insurance industry and they're important members of our community, and I was going to ask you, are there, although maybe I should have asked them, do you see any potential benefits to consumers from sort of streamlining this stuff and having it done centrally? Is a central regulator potentially more resourced, have a greater set of people who can ask better questions, learn better stuff, and is it some advantage of centralization?
Sir, Chair and members, I do not see the benefits of this bill to the insurance buying public. We already have excellent laws on the books which are used by the insurance commissioner's office. There are three people who work on the life insurance products, which are life insurance and annuities. Then you have the health insurance products. There are two, three people work on those products. When I was working in 85 through, I used to be the only officer who handled all the health insurance products until we passed so many laws that I needed some more help. Then I asked for the commissioner. Mr. Kulangaski used to be my insurance commissioner for 40 years. He and I worked together very closely to a lot of the laws, especially like the long-term care insurance, which is being changed. I don't want these laws to be weakened by private company far away, which we have no control over. I don't want you to give away your authority to a private insurance company that they will decide how the policies will be approved in different forms. I would like to ask Ms. Miller, would they be as good as the Oregon laws will approve these policies? That's what I would like to know, sir.
Smith, Representative Smith, you had a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that helping, sir?
It is helpful. Do they, and I don't know too much about this, but
yes, sir.
Is there any substantial difference, or has there been, in your experience, has there been any significant difference between the rules and decisions of the compact and the rules and standards of Oregon? I could imagine saying, well, maybe we just care about state sovereignty, we're special, but is there any merit to it? Is there any difference between those two?
The only person who can answer that question is Teresa Miller, our deputy commissioner. Because as I have told you, I have been retired since 2002, sir, and I have not looked at their rules. That's what I want to know. This, your authority shouldn't go away, and this law should say that the insurance policies for these four lines, life insurance, annuity, disability, and long-term care, they would comply with the Oregon stand law insurance we have passed. Because I used to work with the with the legislature when I was working with them. And I used to get a request from a lot of states out of the whole country saying, please send us your laws, because they were that good. And I'm wondering if these policies will be approved as good as our Oregon laws, sir. This is what is bothering me. That's the only reason I'm here today.
Last question.
Yes.
Last question. Thanks again.
Yes,
and I did have a chance to talk to Teresa about this a little bit. During your time period,
yes, sir.
Do you recall there being regulations and rules in Oregon?
Yes.
That were substantially different from the rules and regulations in other states?
Yes,
that
sir,
you were
very
aware?
Much so. Our rules were a lot better. Our products were a lot better. For example, I can give you one example, sir. I would read every insurance policy, make sure everything is okay, even if some of the statements in the policies were not in the law, but they were not very good for the insurance buying public. So I would call the insurance company, I would say, I don't think these provisions you have in the insurance policy are good for the insurance buying public. And the attorney would say, Mr. Sander, you're right. How do you know? I said, I read the policy. He says, 29 states have approved this policy. You are the first one to bring this to our attention. That's how our dedicated people are serving the insurance commissioner's office. That's where I was for 17 years. And they would say, okay, I understand what you're saying. We will take out these provisions. I don't think that will happen to these products being approved somewhere else, sir. That's what I'm worried about.
Thanks very much.
Chair Hovey.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing us your concerns on this.
Yes, sir.
As the insurance division was testifying, Teresa Miller,
yes, sir.
It seemed to me that we weren't really losing our authority in this, that this was being added to our insurance statutes, and that she testified that the insurance division could basically make a decision to opt out or to look at this and say this really doesn't measure up according to our standards. And even though we're adopting their process, their rules, their standards,
yes,
the insurance division still has the ultimate authority over these products in Oregon, and I would assume that they would be looking at these products that are being approved by the compact and making a decision on whether or not they were appropriate or met high enough standards for Oregon. So you have a different point of view on that process. So can you tell me where is the breakdown in that process if Oregon decided that they
in
didn't?
This statute, sir, I do not see anywhere where it states that the insurance policies approved by the compact will meet the same or better standards than the Oregon laws. It does not say anywhere that I saw it anywhere, sir.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that. And if we are going to review the policies after the compact has reviewed, why have them reviewed them? Because we have better laws in Oregon than in the whole country. Then why, I mean, what purpose would it serve to have the compact to review them if we're going to review them anyway? I don't understand that. I don't see. I see that your authority is being moved to the private corporation. Isn't that true? I would like to ask Ms. Miller to answer that question, sir. She's the only one who can answer that for you. But I don't think this law should be passed as it is unless it simply says that the policies approved by the compact must meet the Oregon laws. And it doesn't say that here, sir. I don't see that anywhere in there.
Okay.
That's what's bothering me.
Okay,
because
sir.
I have
okay.
been serving the public, and I still serve. I'm a Shiba volunteer. I train Shiba volunteers in the state of Oregon, if you know what that is, Seniors Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program.
Yeah.
And I trained the original ones back in the 90s when I was the compliance officer, because nobody else seemed to know anything about health insurance. They would say, please train us. So that's what I did originally.
Okay. Sir, thank you very much.
You're welcome,
for
sir.
Your,
any other questions?
No,
yes, sir.
Thank you. I just always like to take the opportunity to thank somebody who influenced my life. You won't remember this, but when I was 20, we visited about the student government insurance, and you were so tenacious in your interpretation
yes,
that I had to come to the legislature to undermine my boss I was working for at the time
right.
and get a statute changed so we could hold the insurance policy. So thank you for helping me now end up here, because that was the first time I ever got a
I remember house. Working with you, sir, because we wanted to. And I, if you don't mind for 1 second, later on, lobbyists wanted to change that law. They wanted to add the mental health and alcoholic coverage and other, and I knew the premium was going to go sky high. So Mr. Johnson from Grand Pass was the chairman on the committee, and he was listening bill, and I told my commissioner, I said, I don't think this bill should be policy and the standard for the college insurance should be changed by adding all these coverages because the premiums will go up. And when I said, tell the legislature that, ask the lobbyists, isn't that true? Did they give him the information, chairman, that the premium will go up? And the chairman said, lobbyist, will the premiums go up? He said, yeah, but you didn't give it to me. And he puts his hammer, he says, this bill is gone. After that, they wouldn't let me come back to the legislative lobby because they said, oh, he's telling things we should be able to do. For the last 3-4 years I was there, they wouldn't let me come back to the legislature. Until then, from 85 through or 96 or 7, I used to come to every health insurance hearing bill and would testify work with the administrator because a lot of the bills would have would not comply with the existing law, so I had to tell them, you can't pass a law the way it is. You've got to check the old law on the books. You've got to either refine that or before you pass this.
Well, I remember. It was 93. You were here. I remember.
So thank you very much, sir.
Again, sir, thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for your service to the state, and can you continue to help our seniors in your service. And the members have your testimony. And
thank you, sir.
We're not going to be able to work the bill today. We do not have a physical. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2095.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you for letting me do that.
Okay, committee members, also, I should have to reopen. Have to reopen to put this in.
No, it's been submitted.
Okay. My administrator is being sure. There was a couple letters submitted that will go in the record on that last bill. Okay. We're going to... open a public hearing on House Bill 2046. 2246. House Bill 2246. Mr. Blackmer, you want to come up, please?
Co-chairs Holby and Wisnant, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity for me to speak in favor on this bill. My name is Gary Blackmer, and I'm the director of the Audits Division in the Secretary of State's office. Since 1995, we have operated a hotline that takes calls regarding government waste, fraud, and abuse. And we have encountered situations where the statutes are unclear or they result in difficult situations for us to resolve. Essentially, what these proposed revisions collectively do is increase our ability to make the information and substance of the complaint available to resolve situations, but increase the protections of the callers and their identity. First, what we would like to do is make the identity of the caller of the hotline confidential regardless of the type of call. The statutes protect confidentiality of callers who make reports regarding state activities, but we do get calls regarding local government activities and allegations of fraud, waste, or misuse, and the statutes don't allow us to clearly protect the identity of those callers. So this would expand the protections to all callers to the hotline, regardless of the type of call. Secondly, we'd like to allow the caller to waive the confidentiality, their own confidentiality, if that helps resolve the situation. There have been occasions in the past where a caller wished to have us forward the information on and to directly contact another agency, and we were not in a position where we could clearly do that. We would like the statute to allow us, with the caller's permission, a written permission, to waive that confidentiality. Third, we would also like to be able to forward allegations to other agencies, even those allegations that are not allegation of fraud, waste, or abuse. For example, we might get an anonymous call regarding someone who is not paying their Oregon personal income taxes. We are not allowed to forward that on to the Department of Revenue. These kinds of situations come up occasionally, and allowing us to actually forward information, still protecting the identity of the caller, would help us resolve those matters more easily. Fourth, we have been in discussions with the Department of Justice around the access to the records related to our investigations. And we're in agreement with their proposal that at the completion of our investigation, our work papers would be available at request. We would make sure that any information identifying the caller in any way would be removed from that those work papers, so that if someone wanted to see what happened as a result of a complaint, we would be able to provide some information. Right now, the only time we can provide information about our activities is when we find a sustained call regarding fraud, waste, or abuse, and we make a public report at that time. This change would also allow us to publicly report on the types of calls we get, the agencies that they involve, and so forth. This was an issue that Representative Cameron, I believe, brought up at a previous hearing when he was asking about our office and the hotline. And lastly, and I think most significantly, there are other government hotlines in the state. There are three local government hotlines, and it's unclear whether they can protect the identity of their callers under Oregon statutes regarding public records. And we would like to be able to extend equal protections to callers to any local government that operates a hotline, essentially under the same kind of framework that we operate on here. Excuse me. Right now, there are three local government hotlines in Oregon. Suzanne Flynn, the Metro Government Auditor, operates one. LaVon Griffin-Vallade, the Portland City Auditor, has a hotline, as well as Multnomah County Auditor Steve March, who used to be a representative here in the House. He operates a hotline as well. And we think it's important for all governments to be able to afford their callers protections. So that is essentially what we're hoping that you will review and consider. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Committee members, thank you. Mr. Blackmer. Committee members? Mr. Blackmer, I have a couple of questions. First of all, also thank you, and the committee has received your answers to my questions from your February the 1st informational presentation. I appreciate your answers to my questions I presented to you. Thank you very much. Committee members, we do have letters of support from cities and City of Portland, and who else?
Multnomah County Auditor, and from Metro, Suzanne Flynn, the Metro Auditor. All three are letters in support of the bill.
But we don't have anyone from AOC or LOC asking to present. Are they okay? Because the bill does authorize local governments. It does not require them to have a hotline, but authorizes them. That's correct.
That's correct. I had contacted the organizations that currently have hotlines, and they were strongly in favor. I have not contacted the League of Oregon Cities or Association of Oregon Counties regarding that.
Thank you, sir. Another question is, maybe not this session, next session we can work on a government hotline for good practices, not waste, too. Or so. That's what we need. So thank you. If there's no other questions by the committee, thank you. We'll, okay. There is going to be a small amendment from...
Yeah, maybe ask him to.
You want to talk about the amendment?
Co-chairs Holvey, co-chair Wisney. Yes, we have been in discussion with Department of Justice to reconcile the measures or their bill regarding public records with ours. And so what we think that we are in agreement with them, and so what we just need to do is prepare an amendment and bring it in.
Okay, do you want, also, Mr. Blackmer, then maybe do you want to touch base with Mr. Gallagher? Have you talked to him on this? Is there?
We have talked to him on another matter, not on this one, but we will do that.
Thank you. If we're going to have to bring it back, please be sure we don't have any big issues with him. We've had already discussion. I think you were here part of that discussion.
That's correct.
So, Mr. Chair?
One question just popped in mind. Can you clarify for me just a little bit more about the confidentiality piece? On this, is the intent to protect the person that's making the report of the waste, or or is it actually the substance of the report that you're keeping confidential?
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisman, at this point, we have to keep everything confidential unless we find a sustained allegation of fraud, waste, or abuse. What we would hope to do would be to make the substance more available, but strengthen the protections of the caller so that we would make sure that the caller's identity could not be determined, but we would be able to either forward information to other agencies, make our work papers available, or provide, for example, in an annual report, the kinds of calls in general and the disposition of those calls.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cameron. Thank
you. Maybe I'm not quite aware. So we have a hotline. People call in, but that information today can never be disclosed.
That's correct.
Of what the subject, I mean, so we have a problem in an agency. Somebody calls in and says, here's a problem, and it just sits there on a recorder?
Co-Chairs Holvey, Co-Chair Wisen, Representative Cameron, no, we get that information and we investigate it, but we cannot publicly disclose what the call was or how we disposed of it.
Okay, but it is investigated.
Yes, sir.
If I may
follow up,
Chair, are you able to contact the person who made the complaint?
Co-chairs.
In the investigation process.
Co-chairs, Representative Cameron, we will if the caller provides information about who they are and some contact information. We also have a website where we can refer them, where if they're anonymous, they can refer to the website. If we have further questions, they can look and see the status of their call and respond to any questions there and maintain their anonymity. So we do get a number of calls that are anonymous, and the only way we can communicate is to post something on the website that they can look at, respond to on the website. But we do, in many cases, get information on the caller. We have communications with them. We provide them updates on what's happening. So we do the best we can to ensure that they know the resolution of their call.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Klim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm interested in what kind of calls people call in with. Is it specific allegations usually of mismanagement or something in, you know, in their area, or is it general ideas like, you know, why do we have this law? Why does government do this? Why does this aid? Why do I have to get three permits for the same thing?
Co-chairs, Representative Klim, all of the above. And I think to the degree that we would rather have people call us with any concerns or allegations,
mm-hmm.
rather than requiring them to filter them in some way, we will try to make sure that we have a clear understanding of specifically the issue, so that we will get that in the course of our preliminary investigation. But many of the calls really don't lead to a final report because they are general or they're not relevant to our work. They may be regarding a federal agency or a supervisor who they believe is conducting themselves improperly.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Mayor,
please follow up.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this for about a year now. I had about four bills last session that came from people who just called me, and they said, well, why is this the case? Why can't I sell my food to the prison anymore? I used to be able to. So I call over there, and they explain that you guys passed a statute saying it's low bid, and if you are 1 cent more, it doesn't matter if the guy's right down the street and the other food's coming from, you know, Argentina, doesn't matter. And so we did a bill, and it passed, and another one on something in this committee on 80-20. Somebody called me and said, you know, this is a flaw in the law. Why don't you do that? So I've thought about when citizens encounter red tape, essentially. I'm not so worried about the specific allegations of abuse, because there's another way to handle that. I mean, illegal activity in an agency, something like that. I'm thinking more about red tape and process reform, and why doesn't the government do X, Y, and Z? And I knew people called in there, but I know I don't see those things, which I think is the point of this. And certainly, if you had a hotline and there was at least some filter for what's appropriate for legislators to be looking at to deal with policy issues and problems and what isn't. I think you'd, you know, we'd find that if there was some website we could go to and see what people said, you'd see a lot of activity. I mean, somebody would be interested in somebody's suggestion, you know, whether it's their constituent or not. Somebody would be interested in that. And I've been trying to think about, you know, do you have to have a separate red tape hotline, or could you just take the ones that come in that are appropriate for policymakers? You know, who want to, and maybe some oversight issues. I mean, you know, I don't know where the right personnel type complaints would be. I don't know that that's something we need to deal with. The agencies need to in some cases. But anyway, I think I'm supportive of this concept for that reason. A bunch of the good ideas that I've had certainly didn't emanate from my head. And I don't know how to get access to that line. It sounds like I probably couldn't right now if I wanted to.
Co-chairs Holvey and Wisdom, yes, this would allow us to be able to report on those kinds of red tape or policy issues that technically are not, government waste or abuse. They may be inefficiency, but it doesn't fall within the purview of the statutes that we would be able to pursue and investigate. It might generate a potential audit, and we do see topics that we add to our long list of potential audit areas out of those calls, but there may be others that in our report legislators could see and consider possible statutory changes.
Nancy's here. Okay, committee, no further questions. Be sure I hit the right one. This is 46. With that, thank you, Mr. Blackmer, again for your testimony. We'll not be having a work session because we have an amendment that's got to come in on this. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2246. And I see Representative Nathanson's here. So what I'll do, committee members, is we'll pull up... I'm going to do 2367. That's what you're here for. Okay, so I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2367. Do we have one first? Yeah, Representative, would you like to come up, please? Good morning, thank you. And even our members, we remind, please identify yourself and present your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. House Bill 2367 is about county law libraries. I requested that this bill be drafted after being approached by my local government. On hearing the simplicity of the idea, I thought, how could this not make sense? The immediate question was this. Would it be all right for a county to satisfy their statutory obligation, in other words, a state mandate, to provide the public with law library service? Is there a way to do it more efficiently? Or does a county have to literally have a full-time, fully staffed, separate physical presence? In other words, a law library. Because when you see the word library, you think of a physical structure. Counties are under increasing financial stress. Fortunately, there are at least two ways of addressing resource constraints: technology and intergovernmental cooperation. With this proposal, we're recognizing that the world has changed. Since statutes were written decades ago, communications are no longer only on paper or by telegraph or by telephone. Information is recorded through many types of media, not just only printed on paper. And library services are not limited to just what happens inside a physical building. The nature of providing library services is changing, and the law libraries have just completed a very careful forward-thinking analysis of how to deliver services. New technologies offer additional options for providing law library services throughout the counties. This bill proposes two pretty simple solutions. One, change the state mandate from operating a law library, which most people envision as a building, to providing law library services. The change adds flexibility for counties while ensuring Oregonians receive access to a law library and resources. And two, make it clear that the county may arrange for law library service through agreements, such as a contract with a law library association or another entity. That's it. It's about technology, and it's about intergovernmental cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions, committee members? Chair Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I was just kind of curious about this, and I should have asked you this earlier, but it just kind of popped into my mind. So the agreement or contract for library services, is it restrictive in any way? I guess I'm going, could a county make an agreement with a particular law firm that has a library or access to those services to provide those services to the county? Or is it an intergovernmental agreement that you're speaking with?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not sure that the language is specific enough to prohibit it. However, there's language that indicates that this is about operating a free law library at a location that is convenient and available at reasonable hours. So that is emphasized in the language. I know that the impetus for this, if you can envision, for example, in this area, there's the state law library, there's also Willamette University, there's also a county building where legal materials are available. In the Eugene Springfield area, there's a county law library, but there's also the University of Oregon Law Library within a very close distance of one another. And there's the idea, do there need to be two physical law libraries so close by, or could they make arrangements with each other to provide service? So that was the incentive, and I think you'll hear more about the incentive and the possible solutions from other testimony. I know that I didn't receive any suggestions that arrangements or contracts would be made with private firms. That didn't come up as part of the planning that was presented to me.
Thank you. Other questions, Chief Hovey?
That scenario just popped up in my brain that, you know, if you're in a rural area that maybe not doesn't even have a law library pretty close to it, maybe they could contract with another part of the state that does have those services. Mm-hmm. And then it popped in my mind that maybe there was a local attorney who had, you know, access to those services, and so I was kind of wondering about that relationship. And, you know, I guess I'm a little concerned about I haven't really thought through the issue there of a private firm providing those services. So.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for putting forward the bill. A couple questions, and maybe you don't have the answers, maybe somebody else that's going to testify, but I noticed the word free is in here a couple of times, and my concern is, where is the funding coming from now to fund our law libraries? And maybe you have that answer, and how much funding is there today?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the funding comes from a dedicated stream. There's a committee that had been working over the past year and a half, as a matter of fact, called the Interim Committee, Joint Committee on Justice System Revenues, where we were investigating where does all the money come that funds not only the courts but all the related activities that the legislature over the decades has said this is fundamental to the court system. The law libraries are funded by a dedicated fee at the current time. There's a proposal to change the way that fees are collected and distributed, but it would still, under the proposal, it would still be funded through fees that are charged. For example, when you file filed to go to court, there's a bunch of fees on there, and one of those is going to law libraries. So there's a funding stream that goes to counties, and then counties are supposed to use it to to have law libraries. Of course, one of the points was in some counties, they may be keeping a law library open, but, you know, all day, every day, but have only two or three visitors a week because it's in a sparsely populated county and there's not a lot of call for it. Other places, there may be a lot of traffic and a lot of public use of law library services, but some of that may be online or by telephone. Anyway, the funding is there. There's already a funding stream, and that's being discussed by Judiciary Committee right now, as a matter of fact.
Committee members, I sit on Judiciary, and the Representative's bill was presented to Judiciary yesterday, and we're working through that process. So I've been advised we can go ahead and proceed on our bill, although Judiciary is looking at the fee structure, that our bill is just giving an opt-out to counties. We're not going to move the bill today. I think Representative Cameron, I didn't tell you, we're going to add an amendment, but we'll not move the bill. When you can still continue questions, I just wanted to clarify
okay.
So we didn't get into the...
Well, and Representative brings up a real good point as to two or three people, and I think that's the information we need to know is how many people, you know, what's the fees being collected in a particular county based on the court fees for a library, how many people are actually accessing it as we kind of move forward and make these decisions. That'd be my comment, and thank you, Representative.
Thank you for that. Representative Smith, did you have something?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. How is it, because there was a little bit of discussion about this behind your back before the hearing, and with regard to, not about you personally, everybody adores you, but about the fee stuff, and I'm, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not privy to all that information. Is there anything about the fee discussions that interacts negatively with your bill, right? Is there any, like, it seems like this might be the kind of thing that would save smaller counties money, not cost them money, but is there anything we need to know about how it interacts with the fee questions?
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for asking that. I think the two bills are related only in that one creates a funding to send to the counties to do this. This bill simply is giving more flexibility to counties how to satisfy their statutory obligation to provide library services. Right now, it says they have to provide a library, and the question was, well, can we just... The way I looked at it, I said, shouldn't we just say library services? And then you figure out more cost-effective ways of providing the service as long as it's still providing public free access to legal information and resources and so forth. And the Law Library Association has done a very good, thorough study. There is information about the use of law libraries from one place to another and the cost of providing certain kinds of services and what could be done.
Thank you very much. Chair Hovey.
Just to clarify your point, because I think it's a very important one, is that this bill basically allows some efficiencies, essentially, so that the counties don't have to provide a law library. They can accommodate this through just providing the law library services, and that's the main piece of this bill that allows tremendous efficiency and perhaps a cost saving to counties, I would imagine.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you. That's it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to bring up Mrs. High and Mr. Snyder together, please. And to have another person to testify, Mr. Collar from Lane County, and he has the amendments. I'll leave him up at the end so we can do them. No, just wait and do the amendment. Go ahead, and our friends, we know that you know the process. Ladies first, Paul.
Oh.
State your name, please, and give us your testimony.
Co-Chair Wisnat and Co-Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Library Association in support of House Bill 2367. I think you've hit on some of the key points involved in this issue. Our members believe that having free legal information available to all Oregonians is very important. the key is how to deliver that service. As I testified to Judiciary this week earlier on House Bill 2710, the bill you were talking about, the issue is that some counties offer very little service right now. There's one county I saw that gets less than $2,000 a year from the litigant fees that pay for this service. Well, for $2,000 a year, the people in that county aren't getting the service. This is not necessarily an easy position for our association. We have 900 members, and of course we have library trustees and private college librarians, but many of our members are public employees, and this bill says contract out for services. But the key for our members was exactly that word. These services, they're important. We believe that all Oregonians should have access to these services, and we're going to have some flexibility in the system to provide that, and that's why we support this bill. We think that it would fit in well with the model we would like to see, and it would be done in this other bill, would be something that allows for agreements among counties and perhaps overseen by the state law librarian to make sure that there is access across the state. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Bless your members. Co-chair. Bless your members and tell them thank you. Any questions for Mrs. Hunt? I'm sorry. Chair Hovey, you got to get that hand up.
I can't believe I have so many questions about this all of a sudden, but are there any standards for what is provided, what kind of information is provided by a law library?
Co-Chair Wisniak, Co-Chair Hovey, I don't know whether there are official standards. There are certainly standards that the law librarians have worked out. There's a wonderful report that the State Library commissioned with a federal grant last year. It was just issued in December. And it goes into great detail about who uses the services, how they are funded, and yes, what kind of standards there are. And that's where we got the recommendations that we're making today.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
And so do you envision any problems if in fact, these library services are provided by a private firm? You know, there would be some sort of standards on what those services are, what they're providing.
Co-Chair Hovey, I think that's why our association would like some oversight, perhaps by the state law librarian, to make sure that there isn't that kind of a conflict.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Snyder, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Wisniak, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties and appearing in support of House Bill 2367. I think the testimony from Representative Nathanson and Ms. Heim has pretty much nailed the issues that we find to be favorable with regard to this bill. I'd also like to point out, though, that we have already in statute under ORS Chapter 190 what we consider to be pretty liberal laws in terms of intergovernmental agreements and intergovernmental cooperation. And a number of counties have already taken that statute and used it as a basis to provide some law library services in locations other than in the county courthouse, and to some degree by other public bodies. So in Eastern Oregon, for example, in Union County, it's Eastern Oregon University where the county law library is housed. And that's just an example. What this would do would be to expand that authority a little bit farther, as is in the case right now for Multnomah County. It would just apply that same standard that Multnomah County has to deliver services to counties with a population of less than 400,000 people. So we're supportive of the bill and recommend it to you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Further questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I may, some issues have come up by county law librarians with respect to how this bill might actually play out. And we'd like to have a dialogue with some of those who express concern about it. But, for example, in response to Representative Polvey's questions about law library services going through a private law firm, nonetheless, it's important to recognize that the statute will still control who the services are delivered to and under what general circumstances. So it says right now and it would still, under this bill, available to attorneys and to litigants. Litigants is a pretty broad group of people, and it's got to include the pro se folks. I mean, those are the people who really need these law library services monumentally. I've heard, for example, that in domestic relations cases, upwards of 80% of these cases involve at least one person who is unrepresented by an attorney. These people need these services. And if a law library thinks it can provide those to the pro se litigants who can just walk in the door and use the law library, I'm not sure very many law firms would want to do that.
So, Mr. Snyder, we have a letter. Does all the committee people have the letter?
Mm-hmm.
From the Oregon Council of County Law Libraries. That's who you're speaking about?
Yes, sir.
Okay. It might help them with my spelling of my name. I've never seen it that way. Okay, any further questions, committee members?
Just one point, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes.
I guess part of my concern wasn't really about, I guess what you're describing. My concern was really about if, in fact, these services were provided by a private organization or company or individual even, that there was some sort of standard for the quality of that service, so that inadvertently we didn't let you know you didn't have access to these important chapters of series of books or whatever may be needed for you to get a full understanding of the information that's available out there. So that was kind of my concern, was the quality of the service being delivered if this, in fact, went through some sort of private service.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your testimony, Mr. Collar, will you please come up and give us your testimony, and we'll try to get the amendment in before. Thank you, and please state your name and give us your testimony.
Co-Chairs Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnant. I am Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I'm handing out some information about Lane County's Law Library, and I have just six copies of the amendment. I was under the assumption
we
that the
it.
Committee
we
has it.
It.
Okay. At any rate, Lane County is in favor of House Bill 2367. We were alerted to a bit of a drafting omission on the bill that we feel like the -1 amendments will fix, and I can speak to that first. It has to do with how the construct came out in the bill under Section 3. It suggests that counties that don't have over 400,000 inhabitants should just operate a free law library. That's in subsection 1, operating a free law library. And it was pointed out to us that, in fact, the previous language had said acquiring, maintaining, or operating a free law library. So the amendment simply does that, is makes it consistent with how the statute read previously. You can see from my handout some of the information about Lane County's law library. I will note that my spell checker under clientele, under the first section, talks about people who represent themselves as proper litigants, as opposed to, I suppose, improper litigants, but it actually should have said pro se litigants. But those are the majority of the people that the county law library serves. We did seek this bill, though, in that we were and we are anticipating pretty extreme cuts in our budgetary future. Committee members may know about Secure Rural Schools and the federal legislation that provides in the past has provided an enormous amount of revenue for counties. We're looking at that that revenue going away, and the county's undergoing reviews wherever it can to see if it can have efficiencies. This was one that the county administrator brought to my attention and asked, could we get this fixed to see if we could gain some additional flexibility? It was our intent only to suggest that counties would be on the same footing, Lane County would be on the same footing as a county with over 400,000 population, and that we could provide services if we needed to in a different manner than we have currently. I will speak a bit to, if you look under the financial and other information there at the bottom, the question came about how we're funded. It is from a 28% fee on filing fees that are filed in Lane County. That has a we budgeted, for instance, last year $325,000 for the operation of the law library. It has two full-time equivalent staff people. It also pays sort of a centralized support fee, as do most departments in the county, to sort of make sure that the county operates with all its parts funded. We do have a special revenue fund that accumulates excess revenue, and I should have noted that's just for the law library. It is a separate fund just for the law library. We've got $208,000 in that fund right now. The fund has paid for some repairs in the past. We had an asbestos issue in the courthouse in the law library, and then we had some water damage here earlier this year. So that's sort of the fund, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have about the bill.
Thank you very much. Committee members, test any questions? Any questions? Again, that's good. I was going to say let's keep it not to the amendment, so we'll go to the amendment. So no questions. Thank you. Why don't you stay there, and we'll open the hearing work session on the amendment. So we'll close. This is this one here. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2367. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2367, and this work session will be to accept the amendment LC1. Chair Hovey, you
want to? Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2367.
Dated.
February 8th, 2011.
Thank you very much. Committee members, Mr. Collard talked about why he added this in. Is there any further questions of him or me or the committee about the amendment? Seeing none, then we're going to have a roll call. Yes, on the amendments real quickly. So roll call, please.
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holden.
Aye.
And Co-Chair Wissett.
Aye. The amendment is introduced. Is that the correct term? Or
adopted.
So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2367. We have about 5 minutes to look at House Bill 2244. So, committee members, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2244. And we have one person to testify on that. That is Mrs. Hecker. Please state your name. Welcome this morning, and hope you can have some concise testimony.
I will, and I speak.
And we're not going to be able to obviously have a work session, be a public hearing. So thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I am the director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2244, which would amend the definition of a public record currently found in ORS 192.005 and 192.410. In addition, we are requesting an addition to ORS 192 that would require state agencies to have written policies and procedures that address the use, access, retention, and ownership of public records. We've been working closely with the Department of Justice and to reconcile the language so that we can both use the definition, and we've come to an agreement, and so we would like to propose a slight amendment to that. In addition, we will need to clarify the language as regarding policies and procedures as the Judicial Department was inadvertently added to that, and they have their own statutes on public records. The current statute for public records relating to retention and disposition was written in 1961. In 1973, a very similar law was added relating to public records access. So as we celebrate the 50th birthday of the public records law for retention and the 38th for its younger sibling, the retention law for access, we acknowledge that they were written in a time where technology was in its infancy. In fact, in 1961, a computer probably would have occupied a room this size and required you to learn a foreign language such as Fortran or Assembler to have anything to make it operate. In 1973, computers were much smaller, but we were still 1 to 2 years away from hitting the personal computer marketplace. By 1989, the legislature had added an amendment to the definition that included machine-readable records because they recognized that public business was being conducted more so in the electronic world. But what the law has always assumed is that a public record was something tangible and something that could be captured. So as we've moved further away from conducting business in the paper world, currently we create about 90% of our records information electronically. We've noticed two things, that the current definition of a public record becomes harder to implement and more confusing as to actually what is a public record, especially as it relates to retention and disposition, and that written policies and procedures that address use, access, retention, and ownership of public records are woefully lacking in our agencies. Let me begin by addressing the current definition. The current definition of a public record written for the paper-based world confuses public employees when it comes to what they need to keep to satisfy retention requirements. The definition starts with a public record includes any writing, which immediately leads you to believe that it is a paper record. A public record is a paper record. So many employees, public employees, don't think their electronic records are necessarily public records because they're not on paper. In addition, something like email is not thought of a public nature, not only because it's electronic, but it's also informal in nature, so we have a lot of confusion around that. Others think that as long as they work from home on their home computers, the information that they're creating is not a public record. Because of this confusion, agencies find themselves in court trying to defend their actions or non-actions. Public employees either labor over a decision as to whether to keep the record, or they just decide to keep everything, and all of these are woefully inefficient. So furthermore, the decisions that they are trying to make relate to records that are tangible and easily captured. How can we apply this to the current state of electronic world where with social media, a medium that was never intended to be captured, it was basically created to hold online conversations, and we no longer own it once it's been posted to a social media site. I think that the first step in making us more efficient in managing our public records is to have a definition that is clearly technologically independent and, most importantly, easier for the public employee to interpret. Now I'd like to discuss the second piece of House Bill 2244, is where we would like to add a section that requires state agencies to have written policy and procedures that address the use, access, and retention and ownership of public records. Many agencies, if not most, lack these written policies and procedures, despite the fact that it has always been part of our advice and assistance that we give agencies when we work with them, that they must have written policies and procedures. The addition to the statute formalizes and requires agencies to comply. Without these policies and procedures, agencies have no basis for their approach in managing public records. For example, in the case of email, if it has been misused by public employees, messages have been withheld from public records requests or have been so difficult and costly to obtain due to the agency's uncertainty of their accessibility as a public record, not retained because of the lack of understanding of public records, or having all messages retained because they are too hard to manage, which increases both liability and storage costs. And finally, agencies that have outsourced their email to a third party or have allowed employees to have Gmail, AOL, or Yahoo accounts, and they've now lost custody or ownership of their public records and can no longer manage them for retention and, in some cases, public access, because Yahoo really doesn't care that a record needs to be kept for 5 years. Yahoo will retain the message according to Yahoo's needs, not the state of Oregon's needs or our requirements. If state agencies were required to have written policies and procedures, it would put them in better stead in the case of litigation, allow them to address these issues up front before they become problematic, allow them to train their employees on the proper management of public records, and help to ensure that the public records are retained according to Oregon's rules and statutes, and have provisions for maintaining public records in public custody. The amendment to the definition of a public record will go a long way to clarifying what a public record is, and the addition of the requirement for written policies and procedures will help hold agencies accountable for the management of their public records. Both the amendment to the definition and the addition requiring written policies and procedures help to make government more transparent and more efficient. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Mrs. Powell, will you come up and give us your name in case of questions? Just to identify yourself and say you're available for questions.
Co-chairs, Representative Winsent and Holvey. My name is Patty Powell. I'm an assistant legal counsel for the Oregon Judicial Department and the Office of the State Court Administrator. We're working very closely because of an inadvertent error in the drafting of this bill, which seems to include in its definition of a state agency the Oregon Judicial Department. The legislature has given, historically, the State Court Administrator and presiding judges control over their own records, and we work very, very closely with the State Archivist in constructions of our policy manual. We already meet everything in this bill.
Okay.
It just were included, and we're going to work an amendment to keep us out of this bill.
Okay, thanks for that testimony. Committee members, do you have any questions in our short period left? And this will be coming. We'll have to bring this back for the amendment and also see Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Fiskum to testify on this bill. So I don't know, are they going to be working with you, Mrs. is on the changes? Are they impacted in this work group? Or?
We will, if they have issues.
No, they said they have no issues.
Okay.
Go ahead, Chair Hovey.
I'm just a quick little question while you're both up there. I see that each state agency is responsible to have their own written policy. Is there an effort to try to make that at least as consistent as possible amongst the agencies? Different agencies?
Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey, all the policies and procedures would have to come through the State Archivist to be approved before they're put in it, and so that we would make them consistent so that everybody is operating from the same page.
Good question. Any other questions, committee members? Okay, well, thank you for your testimony, and we'll look for the amendment. I think it makes sense and understand your issue with it, and hopefully we can find good policy. And have they signed up?
They did not.
You're up, signed up to testify. Thank you.
I will now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Fiskum, did you want to testify?
Chair Hovey, Chair Wisnett, Tom Gallagher, representing newspaper publishers. It's a pleasure to support this bill. It's a good bill.
Mr. Chair, Dave Fiskum from the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Good bill should pass. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They're put on there. They support. Okay. Very good. Thank you, committee members, for all your work today. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2244. Oh, we have to adjourn the meeting. Yeah. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.